Hey, welcome to the Life 2.0 podcast. I'm John St. Augustine. Glad to have you joining me wherever you're at listening in this big wide world of ours. Time to go up the down staircase, kids, in the outdoor. Make sense out of the senseless. And you know what? If at all freaking possible, let's find the obvious buried in the absurd, eh? Let's get to it. Okay, glad to have you, as I said, joining me one more time here on this esteemed platform. And in full disclosure, it is 5:19 a.m. Central Standard Time. It's still dark out. The coffee is on, as it should be, and as it is every single morning. And my voice is still not in human voice mode. It sounds in my ears a little bit like a cross between John Wayne and Kermit the Frog, whatever that means. I got the heat on in the studio. I got the on-air light all lit up and ready to go. And this today is like a virtual, let me put it this way. In 5 hours, I'll be in front of a room full of people at the beautiful Abbey Resort in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, courtesy of my gal pal Jen Weigel and my friend Amy O'Keefe. And they have this big event that they do every year called the All Souls Weekend. Now, last year, because of the Cyrus the virus, there was no All Souls Weekend. So this is kind of their comeback trail. And it's an extremely popular event. People literally fly in from all over the country and sometimes the world to descend on Lake Geneva and specifically Williams Bay, which is in the west end of things, and attend this event because it does some really important work, meaning that it brings people together and we need that. And it also reminds us of who we are, and we need that, and who we are not, and we need that as well. So I was very excited to be asked to do this. And since most of you won't be there, I thought to myself, what if I just did a little kind of side event just for the podcast folks this morning? And what I thought I would do, and again, forgive me for the voice thing, but I was out I was out early yesterday, which was an interesting deal, for all the wrong reasons. And what I mean by that is I have some dear, dear friends, Greg and Debbie Daniels, who I played semi-pro football with Greg on the Chicago Panthers here. And this is a 6'6" guy who they stuck an offensive tackle across from me, and we've been friends ever since. And their son, Nick, died in battle in Afghanistan 10 years ago yesterday on the 5th of November. That's when they got the knock on the door and their world changed forever. And so pretty much every year for the last 10 years, people convene there and they go to their bar, which is called On the Rocks. And that bar actually was purchased with the death benefit, which is the two words that shouldn't be in the same sentence, death and benefit, from Nikki's passing. And so that bar stands as a testament to Nick and his family, and it has become like family when you go there. And I'm lucky they let me in. You know, there's all these jarhead Marines there, but they let the Coast Guard guy in, so I F and I on that. But yesterday I was there, and it's of course bittersweet. It's always good to see him. I just wish it was for different reasons. And it's one of the things that kicked me into a lot of what I'll be talking about later this morning, which is the time we have and the time we don't have and how we use that. But the voice thing comes, I'm sure, from, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 shots of Maker's Mark or something and running into friends and talking above the din of a bar where you got to kind of shout at each other. And you do that for about 3 or 4 hours. My vocal cords are stretched. They're not quite back where they're supposed to be. So hopefully later this morning, that'll all be in place. But that's what I was out doing yesterday afternoon. I feel like I need to be there with them, if only just to sit, and so that they know that, and they do know, it's not just me. Believe me, there's a lot of people there that that are surround them, and they know that, and it's again one of those things that is a sobering reminder to me, because what I'll be talking about later today is how many days we have. Part of the talk I'm doing is called Every Moment Matters, which is the title of my second book. And I'm actually working on the audio version of that as I speak. And I think I'm about 3/4 of the way through the chapters and editing and all that kind of stuff. And maybe it'll be out by Christmas. And, you know, people can listen to the Every Moment Matters book on audio, even though it's 11 years old now. Man. But interesting enough, as I'm reading stuff I've written over a decade ago, actually longer than that, because those books take, you know, that one took 2 years, I think, to write on and off. My life has changed dramatically since I wrote that book. And it's hard for me sometimes to go in and read it again because what was so prevalent then is non-existent now. But all of that being said, the Every Moment Matters concept that I came up with is just that. Humans, among all creatures, have the unique ability to decide and determine what something means or doesn't mean. And time and value, how those two things come together, that's part of all that. You know, there's no guarantee you're going to be here tomorrow. And yet we walk around as if that's the truth. And it's not. So the talk I'm giving later today, while it's called Every Moment Matters, is also tied into my book, Phenomenon, which just came out last October. I think it's been out actually for a year. I apologize. It came out in October 2020. And that's in audio. So you can find that at Audible if you choose to do that. And so I'll be autographing books and signing them and things like that. And the idea is to, for me, for my portion of this event, is to remind people of that which is unseen is also very, very important. And we can find the extraordinary in the ordinary, but we have to be open to it and be willing to look at it when it shows up and then decide what that may or may not mean. All of this, especially the things that I wrote in the book Phenomenon, in my observation, opinion, and experience, come out of the fact that I basically died twice. It's not something I sit around and talk about much anymore, but when the opportunity is there, I don't mind sharing it. And when I was 19 years old, I was playing college football and working on a partial scholarship, so, you know, you got to work, and that's the way it went. And January 19th, 1978, I was working at the Osco drugstore at Montrose and Pulaski in Chicago and putting cardboard boxes into what's called a baling machine that smashes them and rolls them out like a big bale of hay. There was a malfunction on the reset button. And when I pressed the reset button, that's the last thing I remember for a while. And I came to with this guy sitting on my chest getting my heart going again. His name's Mike. He was a pharmacist who just happened to stay late and who just happened to have been a medic in Vietnam 10 years earlier and just happened to this and happened to that. And fire department first responders, truck number 32, just happened to be driving right by. And so while there was this horrible accident, which I looked at it as at the time, there were other pieces already in place to support me getting out of that. It was like there was this incident, and then I thought it was an accident, but the truth is it's really an event. And how I interpret it, how I value it, what I say it means or doesn't mean is totally up to me. And out of that electrical shock, it was, I don't know how many volts, 550, whatever, I got stuck to the machine, and I still have the scars on my hands to this day, and it was a frickin' mess is what it was, but something changed inside me. I wish I could explain it. I stopped trying to because I can't. I think there's a part of me that will always be as I've been, meaning, you know, I think at my base level, I'm a regular guy. You know, I love watching sports and, you know, and I like to have a good meal and I'll drop an F-bomb with the best of them. And, I've worked jobs that have me dragging my knuckles and I've worked jobs that have me pounding a keyboard. So I think I'm a fairly typical person, but what's happened from that electrocution is it's somehow rewired, I guess, like a sixth sense or something that somehow follows me around and has given me insights to things that were going to happen before they happened. And it's not something I've ever been comfortable with. I'm a very reluctant messenger for the most part. It's just, you know, it's uncomfortable. So in all of that, what I'll be talking about is some of the experiences I've had with the time that I have up there that have left me with my jaw hanging open and my heart wide open and my eyes wide open that I could never have predicted or could have never have orchestrated, but was a total witness to them. And in all of that, when I do the talk and before I get to some of the what we would call woo-woo stuff, it's a setup really, because they're all connected. You know, how much there's life expectancy, which I'll get to in a second, but then there's what your expectancy out of life is. They're very different things. Life expectancy is how long you will live on average, if you're lucky and all your stars line up and other things don't come in and try to take you out. That's life expectancy. But what is your expectation of life? What is it that you expect to put in and get back? Because life is like, you know, it's an investment. And your return on investment is in direct relation, if not greater, to what you put into it. So if you put shit in there, you get shit back. That's what I've learned over the years. And it's never easy to just stay out of the shit sometimes. Like when the shit hits the fan, try to be behind it. But it still comes down to how you see things and how you interpret things and how you determine what a thing is or what it isn't. But life, the other life expectancy that we're used to is, you know, how long you will live on average. And when I started doing this human math talk years ago, life expectancy was 77 and a half. It has gone up to 79 years, basically. It's like 78.9 years. So you round it up to 79 years that the average person, men and women combined in the United States, that's their life expectancy. That 79 years comes out to a mere 28,835 days, if you're lucky. And the whole concept of human math is to get real with the deal. So if I take that 28,835 days, that is like at the end of the arc. That's life expectancy. It's when the average person lives to. And I subtract the days I've already had, that's when shit really starts getting interesting, at least for me. All of this is based on linear math, meaning that when we all grew up, we knew multiplication tables. And when I do this talk, and I may do it later today, and I probably will, I'll ask everybody in the room what 12 times 12 is. Everybody will know, I would hope, that it's 144. Because we all studied the same multiplication tables. Went to your school, and if you went to school in 1942, 52, 62, 72, 82, doesn't matter. Same table, same answer. Linear. 12 times 12 equals 144. And I think what happens to our mindset is that we start to see the world in a linear way. Everything should add up, right? Because it does on TV, so it should add up in our lives, and it never does, rarely does it. So that linear mindset, I think, is a challenge to us to open our minds, because we see things in a straight line for the most part, like beginning, middle, and end, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, 12 times 12 is 144. Life's not linear. It is cyclical. And sometimes you find yourself in positions that you've recognized before, but the characters are different, the people are different, but it's the same situation. Sometimes I feel like that's the universe's way as a pop-up quiz to see if you're still stupid or if you've learned anything. So that's the days, 28,835. So I've already burned up, as of today, 22,995 days. I've already had all those. They're gone, evaporated, history. That's it. 22,995 days I've used up already. If I take the 28,835 and I minus the 22,995, what's the balance on my account? If I'm lucky, if it all works out, if I hit average and my life expectancy goes as most people do here in this country, that means I got 5,839 days left. 5,839. So while it may scare the shit out of you, I think that's a good thing, because those wake-up calls and being more aware in life and having a greater perspective is really important. It is to me. And I think that's one of the things that helps me keep the bubble in the middle of the level of life. You know, you try to keep things level, you get the bubble in the middle. You got to keep dinking around with it to get things leveled out. That's how life is on many levels. No pun intended. So if I have 5,839 days until I'm done, which may or may not be the case, some people get a lot more. I'll get to that in a second. Some people get a lot less. Yesterday when I was at On the Rocks and we were celebrating the life of Nick Daniels, we were celebrating his very short existence. You know, he only got 9,125 days on Earth. That's it. And I've long ago tried to come to some sort of reckoning with how this all works. And I don't know. We're not supposed to know, I guess. The human mind, the ego, wants an answer to everything, try to explain everything, and it's not explainable. So Nikki got 9,125 days, when the average person gets 28,835 days. The bubble is not in the middle there for me. And I look at some of the other people in history who made history in a very, very short time being alive. Joan of Arc, 6,935 days to be alive. I was just talking about John Lennon the other day. And, you know, this guy who was part of the Beatles and brought so much music and good into the world, John Lennon got 14,600 days to do all that. Alex Trebek died last year. You know, Mr. Jeopardy, he was as close as you can get, I think, to that average level or that average number of days, which is 28,835. Alex got 29,200 days, so he just lived just a little bit past 80 years old. Chadwick Boseman, you know, the Black Panther, 16,790 days. Marilyn Monroe and Princess Diana, interestingly enough, both had the same amount of days to do what they did in the world, 14,130 days. So it comes down to a couple things for me, meaning how long you get here is not guaranteed. What I will talk a little bit about later today is, and I'll ask everybody this, and you're getting a little head start, I'll ask everybody if they could take out their driver's license and tell me what their birth date is, and they could all do that. But they don't have a piece of paper that says what their death date is, because we don't know. And so when you come from a place of certainty of how you arrive, but uncertainty when you're leaving, to me that's urgency, and to do things that are bigger and better and greater than just you. But that this is all how I see the world. It's a bit odd, I get it. I've had some incredible influences that urge me in that direction. But the truth is that so much of it for me is perspective. Perspective, perspective, perspective. How you see a thing determines that thing. You know, tonight, Saturday night, there'll be a Powerball drawing. And at one point, the Powerball jackpot was $700 million. The odds of winning that $700 million is like 1 in 292 million. People still throw that cash and they're betting on it. And where was I at the other day? I was thinking, I came into my office and I got a little TV in here and stuff. And I turned on the tube and Jaws is on, which I've seen 350 times. And I get a kick out of it every time. It's just something that's part of my history. And, you know, there was a time I think I could recite the whole movie. But I'm looking at Jaws and I'm thinking about sharks and shark attacks and stuff. And so I went and checked it out. And I've used this number before, but had to reconfirm it. For all the fear in the world about a shark attack, the odds of being killed and attacked and eaten, 1 in 3,748,600. Now, you actually have to be in the water for that to happen. So if you stay out of the water on certain... My point is that so much of this... the odds of being struck by lightning are 1 in 700,000. I don't know what the odds were of me getting electrocuted and surviving. I have no clue. I really don't care. But all those things we look at that we have a thought about them, whether it's, you know, my gosh, you know, they run Shark Week. And the odds of you dying from a shark bite is infinitesimal, just like it is winning the lottery. But I think you've already won the lottery if you're still listening to this. I think that you've had another day. And that I've had another day. And since we don't have that exit paper, that every day is then like winning the lottery. But it's all about perspective. The odds of being born, ladies and gentlemen, are 1 in 400 trillion. The odds of you showing up on the planet in your present form for as long as you have, 1 in 400 trillion. That's a lot of frickin' zeros. And yet, when I watch people argue over gas prices or what's going on in the White House, no matter who the president is, or a zillion other things, I realize they're majoring in minor things. There's something their life isn't giving them, so they have to go look at these issues. And look, I'm not saying that you ignore everything. I'm just saying it's all about perspective. You know, I just yesterday, I'm amazed. It doesn't matter who's in office. But if there's a president in office and the gas prices are low, they're praised for it. If there's a president in office and the gas prices are high, they're damned for it. And the president has zero, I don't care who they are, has zero influence, oversight, or say in what fuel prices are in the country. Zero. So when I see people arguing about something like that, I think, well, that's what are we doing here? Evolving or revolving? So when I look at all those odds, and I start with that 400 trillion mark, you know, when I wrote this up, I'll be using it later this morning, as I mentioned, I had to minus a day because I wrote this yesterday. And as of yesterday, I had 5,840 days to go, but now it's 5,839. I lost it. That day's gone. So I really work hard to stay out of the stuff that I don't need to be involved in. And it's gotten my blood pressure is a lot lower, and it keeps me more balanced. And it allows me, I think, to observe things and be involved in things that I may have missed before. And as I mentioned, going back to electrocution, started all this. It's never gone away. How many years later? Probably 7 years later, I guess it would have been. A couple weeks after I was married in 1986. Was in a very bad car accident, hit broadside by a drunk driver, left for dead, till the paramedics revived me and cut me out of the car. This is number two wake-up call. I don't want a third one. So I got about the business slowly of going within so I don't have to go without. I come from a place that we don't even put hot dogs and ketchup on the same spot, for the most part. You get caught putting ketchup on a hot dog in Chicago, they'll hang you up by your Buster Browns. And if you don't know who Buster Brown is, go check it out on Wikipedia. It's a shoe, and it's also a cartoon character. Anyway, all these things that have come to me, I think would have been wasted if I didn't share them to some degree. Whether people agree or disagree with them, not my job. My job is to deliver the mail. Whether you read it or not, totally up to you. But delivering the mail is part of the way I keep myself upright and breathing and moving forward. If I didn't do it, I would get all constipated spiritually, mentally, and emotionally. There's no question. Because there have been times where I said, I don't want nothing to do with this. I came around again anyway until I like, okay, you win. What do you need? Well, how do I do this? What do I say? And so yesterday, before I went over to the bar, I stopped at a cemetery nearby here. And in a minute or two, I'm going to run a clip. For those of you who have never heard the audio version of Phenomenon, I'm actually pulling a clip of one of the chapters so I don't have to read the thing over again. It's already on audio, so I'm just going to grab that and stick it in here. Of one of the chapters that was just so profound to me and a reminder to me of the brevity of life to some degree and those things that we cannot explain that influence us. I will leave it at that. You'll hear it in the clip here shortly. But I was at the reason I'm saying this, the setup, is I was at the cemetery, Oak Ridge Cemetery, and it ties right into the clip that you'll hear. You've got to pay attention, kids. But in that cemetery, I drove around, as I always do, looking at the headstones. And it's astonishing how old some of them are and sad how new some of them are. But here's the thing I've never seen in years of being in cemeteries and years of going to wakes and years of going to funerals and all that stuff that we all are sometimes too familiar with. Never once, not one time. Yesterday was the ongoing experiment continues, driving around this massive cemetery, looking at these names on these headstones. Not one time have I ever seen Democrat, Republican, Independent, Conservative, or Liberal. Ever. Not a one. Thousands of them. Thousands of them. Not one had to do with anybody's political leanings or inclinations. And when I see that, or don't see that, might be the better way to say it, I am reminded that in this life, so often, because we're majoring in minor things, we are spending so much time which we think is important, it turns out at the end doesn't mean jack shit. It's not even worth putting on a stone. All that time, energy, and effort spent apart from each other, proving ourselves to be right about what? And at the end, you know what you see? Beloved father, mother, sister, brother, auntie, uncle, grandfather, grandmother, veteran. That's what you see. That's what you see on those headstones. And to me, in the end, as in the beginning, that should be kind of the perspective we look at every day. what's going to be there? Is your voting record going to be there? Complaining about gas prices, is that going to be on there? He complained about gas prices, amen. So these experiences I've had have brought me, they call them NDEs or near-death experiences, but they're really near-life experiences. They've brought me more alive when I came out of them. And I've learned that if I kind of snooze off a little bit and get lazy, then other wake-up calls come, and my job is to stay awake. My job is to stay as fully awake as possible. And in turning into someone that I never knew existed, from the guy that I used to be to some greater or lesser degree, my job is not to wake you up. That's your job. My job is to keep more fully awake. And if in these conversations or the books I write or the talks I give or the radio shows I do, that you find value in there and that you expand and broaden your stance and your mind and your heart and all that stuff, then you become more awake. And then you start to see the world differently. And then you realize how much the world is asleep and majoring in minor things. It's quite astonishing, actually. Doesn't make it easier, though. Actually, it makes it a little bit harder. So, again, you know, trying to make people wake up, come on, can't you see this, is a waste of time. Later this morning when I'm up in Lake Geneva, everybody there wants to be there. They want to learn. They want to listen. They want to connect. They want to expand. They don't want to contract. They want to expand. And very few people do that willingly. Life usually pries us open and shoves it right down our frickin' throat until we get it or not. I know people that are this stuff, same shit, different day over and over again and can't see it. But that's for them to figure out. So I'm going to run this clip. This is a chapter from the book Phenomenon. And I'll come up and wrap this thing together on the other side. Chapter 10, Etched in Stone. At 6:30 in the morning on July 24th, 1915, in spite of the steady rain, a massive crowd had gathered and was beginning to board the SS Eastland, docked at the Clark Street Bridge on the Chicago River between Clark and LaSalle Streets. It was, by all accounts, a most anticipated event for thousands of employees of the Western Electric Hawthorne Works Plant based in Cicero, Illinois. They would be embarking on a boat trip across Lake Michigan to the 5th annual company picnic in Michigan City, Indiana. This was a very big deal to most of the employees, many of whom could never imagine taking a holiday such as this one. The Eastland was known as the Speed Queen of the Great Lakes and was one of 5 excursion boats, along with the Theodore Roosevelt, the Petoskey, Racine, and Rochester, that were chartered to take employees to the picnic for a day of relaxation and festivities. In some cases, entire families made their way on board the Eastland in anticipation of the celebration. However, the Eastland had serious design flaws when it was built in 1902, one problem being it was very top-heavy. There were 2 incidences shortly after the ship launched that involved a serious list or lean to one side, and the ship was also damaged when it backed into a tugboat in 1903. In addition, after the sinking of the Titanic in 1912, new rules placed lifeboats and preservers on top of the decks, making the already unstable ship even more treacherous. Shortly after 7 a.m., the ship was filled to capacity with 2,752 people on board, many of them on the upper deck of the boat, standing on the port side, away from the dock side, to get a view of the river. Due to the weight imbalance, the ship began to list towards the water, to which the crew opened the ballast tank so they could fill with water and put the ship back on center line. It didn't work. At 7:28 a.m., the ship suddenly lurched sharply away from the dock and rolled fully on its port side and began to sink rapidly in the murky water. Those who were on the top decks were tossed into the river. Those who had moved below were trapped inside, as the side of the ship came to rest on the bottom only 20 feet below the surface. Those below decks were crushed by the sheer weight of the water, along with heavy furniture and pianos and bookcases and trunks. In spite of the quick response from the Kenosha, which was close by in the river, a total of 844 passengers and 4 crew members died in that tragedy. In just 15 minutes, 22 families were wiped out. The river filled with bodies of infants and children and teenagers and the elderly and every age in between. Well-wishers and neighbors who had come to see their friends off on a holiday ended up using gaff hooks and ladders to pull their loved ones out of the water. Eventually, divers were used to recover dozens of corpses. Bystanders helped, laying the bodies out so they could be transported to the various morgues in the area. And by that afternoon, the remaining unidentified bodies were taken to the armory of the 2nd Regiment on Washington Boulevard, just a few blocks from the river. The Eastland tragedy claimed nearly more than three times the lives of the Great Chicago Fire in 1871. So why the history lesson, you might ask? Well, as it turns out, the 2nd Regiment Armory on Washington Street, where that makeshift morgue was set up with blocks of ice next to the bodies of the Eastland victims, it would eventually become Harpo Studios, home of the Oprah Winfrey Show. I began working across the street from the main studio in 2006, developing and creating Oprah and Friends for Sirius XM Radio, along with a stellar group of broadcasting professionals. I had great satisfaction in building the concept from the ground up to a viable satellite channel for about 4 years. As the senior producer of two daily programs, The Dr. Oz Show and The Gene Chatsky Show, along with Bob Green's weekly hour on health and fitness, my team kept a serious pace, but we had a pretty good time doing it. In October of 2008, we were taping with Gene Chatsky, who was the financial editor of the Today Show at the time, in Edit One, a small studio that we used mostly for post-production, but was occasionally pressed into service to record shows as well. While normally her Oprah radio shows had to do with money, for fun and something a little bit different, I scheduled a Halloween show, and being the pro that she is, Gene went right along with the program. So, Gene was locked in on an ISDN line, which is a closed-circuit dedicated line, from her home outside of New York, and on the guest phone line was my old friend, the late, great Richard Crowe, a.k.a. the Ghost Hunter and lifelong Chicago historian. I'd met this remarkable man at the Alexander Robinson Burial Grounds that you read about in Chapter 3 many years before, and we'd become good friends. So, when it was time to tape a Halloween episode for Gene's show, Richard was my go-to guy. For this particular outing, we had Richard on talking with Gene about all the haunted places in Chicago, the stops he made as the guide of the supernatural tours, which included the site of the St. Valentine's Day Massacre and the aforementioned burial ground of Alexander Robinson, searching for the ghost of Clarence Darrow by the Jackson Park Lagoon, and perhaps most famous of all, Resurrection Mary, who's a hitchhiking ghost that picks up rides in the cars of unsuspecting gentlemen only to vanish when they get to the gates of Resurrection Cemetery. Scary shit. The main reason I wanted Richard on the show was to talk about the Eastland tragedy and the numerous sightings of the Gray Lady in the lower level of the main Harpo Studio building, who is presumed to be one of the drowning victims whose body was brought to the makeshift morgue back in 1915. Now and then, I'd hear the security guys talking about some of the odd noises and things that were purported to be heard when they were walking through the building. Sound of music and crying, and one of them even mentioned there was actually security camera footage of the apparition caught on film as proof. However, none of that stuff ever happened in the building that I worked in, which was located kitty corner, across the street from the main building. Or so I thought. During this particular recording session, there were three and sometimes four of us crammed in the little edit suite. Myself, Katie, who is my board op and editor, Teresa from Legal, and Matt, one of our engineers who always kept a tech vigil whenever we were taping via ISDN. Now, Richard had done a great job of sharing some of his more chilling moments with Gene, who took it all in stride. So, we wrap up the show, thanked Richard for his time and dedication, let him go on the phone, and closed off that line. We're having small conversation via talkback speaker with Gene on the closed circuit line, and Katie's mixing down the audio clip, and Matt and Teresa are just hanging out as we get ready to tape the next show, and that's when it happened. A distended voice fills the room. Niels Peterson will not be forgotten. What was that? And then it happened again. It sounds like it's coming from a small auxiliary speaker that isn't turned on or being used in any way, shape, or form. Niels Peterson will not be forgotten. We all just sat there with our mouths hanging open. Even Gene could hear it through the talkback line all the way in New York. What the f was that, I said. Katie's eyes were big as saucers. Teresa didn't know quite what to say. Matt, being the guy he is, scribbled down the name we all heard. The crew needed a timeout, and I opened the door to that little room, letting some fresh air in, and whatever the hell that was, out. Word of the encounter spread fast, and after another check of the wiring with regards to recording and editing, it was determined there was no way for a voice from any outside source or inside source to have come through that speaker that wasn't even turned on. Eventually, we resumed taping Gene's show with the door open, and that was the end of it, for about 3 hours. Later that afternoon, Matt comes into my office and says, "You're not gonna believe this." He had dug through the list of victims that died in the Eastland disaster. Peterson Niels, a.k.a. Nelson Rasmus, 46 years old, married, Danish, buried in Oak Ridge Cemetery, foreman, Western Electric Company. Unbelievable, and yet we all heard it, from a speaker that wasn't even plugged into the audio board. I don't know how long it took for us to start using that edit suite again or how many times I turned on all the lights if I was working late at the studio, but to this day, if I bring up that visit with those of us that were there, the hair on my neck stands up, like right now. So, what was that all about? All these years later, I'm still not quite sure. Shortly thereafter, I started digging into electronic voice phenomena, or EVP, which are sounds found in electronic recordings that are interpreted as spirit voices that have either been unintentionally recorded or intentionally requested and recorded. It was the famed parapsychologist Konstantin Radiev who popularized the idea in the 1970s and described EVP as typically brief, usually the length of a word or short phrase. But if that's the description, we weren't requesting the presence of Niels Peterson or anyone else for that matter. Now, the short phrase thing fits, and as I recall, the voice was clear, concise, very matter-of-fact, as if making a declaration of sorts, and that multiple people heard it is unusual, as if what, hearing voices from a speaker that isn't plugged in is normal? Whose voice was it? What about Mr. Peterson shouldn't be forgotten? Later that week, I finally mustered up the courage to call Richard at his office and share what happened. He wasn't at all surprised. He thought it was a very cool experience and told me to let him know if it happened again. I assured him he'd be the first person I called, but once was more than enough for me. As I began to make a list of experiences I've had that would eventually become chapters in this book, including those that multiple people witnessed, were of a high priority to me. It's one thing for me to have a dream or a visit or some other unexplained phenomena, but quite another for a group encounter like this one that, in my opinion, lends credibility and credence to the overall message and intent of this book. And what is that message exactly? That there's far more going on than meets the eye, and for whatever reason, at times the veil between here and there is often very thin. These experiences, while at times unnerving, are somehow normal when it comes to the lingering life force of energy that each of us carries while we're alive and apparently can still manifest after we're long gone. The former Harpo Studios is now the headquarters of that fast food chain with the golden arches that sells billions of burgers. Not sure what's across the street where our radio studio used to be. I don't get over to that part of the city much anymore. I often wonder if all that digging in the ground at the site that one time held the bodies of so many that died tragically in the Eastland disaster has further disturbed those who seem to be spiritually interred there, even though their bodies are buried somewhere else. I wouldn't be one bit surprised if they make their presence known in some way, shape, or form. While finishing this chapter, it was on me big time to locate the Oak Ridge Cemetery. And as fate would have it, it's very close to where I live, a short 10-minute walk. We did a little digging, absolutely no pun intended, and found Niels in Section 12, Plot 96. As it turns out, he's buried there with his little 4-year-old son, Royal, who drowned along with his father. His wife, Viola, survived the horror of the Eastland, buried her husband and boy, and after a second marriage and restarting her family, died at the very young age of 37. At first, seeing their names on that grave marker sparked a deep sense of sadness, as I wondered if anyone had visited their resting place in the past century, and then came a feeling of mission accomplished, as the only reason I was even standing on that spot was because of a distended voice on the radio speaker over a decade ago. Over time, their stone had been slowly sliding off its base, and so I moved it back to its original position. I scraped off the lichen and dirt, cleaned out the deep grooves worn into the marker, and oddly enough, If you view the memorial from the side, it's a book carved in stone with Neil's and Royal's names etched on the pages. To that end, I now make routine visits to the resting place of this father and his son. It gives me a chance to take a few minutes to think about that July day 105 years ago, when there was no way that Neil's and Little Royal could have known that it would be their last, and that they would be buried side by side for eternity. And, if nothing else, because you're reading these words, hearing their names, if only for the length of this chapter, they are, in fact, not forgotten. So that was the chapter from the book Phenomenon, Etched in Stone. And there's, I don't know, how many chapters in there, 13, 14, I lost track. Once I write a book, I'm done with it. I don't even, it's just out in the world doing whatever it does. I don't spend a whole lot of time pushing it, promoting it. When things show up, it's there. I just, you know, I'm glad that I wrote it. I'm glad I got everything out. And if I could ever finish these novels that I've been working on, maybe John Grisham and I can have a little bit of lunch sometime and talk about the art and sport of writing, or maybe even Stephen King. But anyway, let me just wrap it up with this. Later this morning on this Saturday, as I said, I'll be up at the Abbey Resort speaking to a sold-out crowd there at this beautiful A-frame they have on the Lake Geneva. It's just a beautiful place. And it'll be the first time I'm in front of real humans for about 2 years, you know, in this context. I've done some, you know, we had the Bulldog Bash for our high school and, you know, you spoke for a couple minutes there. But I'm doing the whole full bring it to the masses kind of deal later this morning. And falling in line with the concept of every moment matters and the ripple effect and paying attention to what's been offered to you and maybe expanding on that, I'll try to wrap this up as quick as I can. I haven't, or I wouldn't be doing this without John Denver. This wouldn't have happened, in my opinion. And what I mean by that, if you've not heard this, I will condense it, because if you have, it's like, what really he's talking about again? Yeah, because I always have to remind myself of how I got where I'm at. There's been a lot of influences in my life, but this guy, the long version and short version is, back in 1991, I was working third shift at the Ramada Hotel O'Hare, which is now long gone, and I was getting ready to go to work at 11 o'clock at night. It's probably 10:30, whatever it was, getting ready. Happened to turn the Tonight Show on with Jay Leno. Jay's first guest was John, and in the open, he mentions that John's going to be at the Wang Center in Boston December 3rd of that year. And I just all of a sudden had this overwhelming feeling that I have to be at the Wang Center on December 3rd for unknown reasons. And I already knew John a bit. I had attended his Windstar Symposiums in Aspen for a few years. And in 1989, he was in Chicago doing an event called Higher Ground. Bill Curtis and I spent the evening with him there. So I kind of knew him a little bit. Love his music, but his work has always been like the priority. I mean, to me, one created the other, but it was more about what he did with the platform than the actual platform himself. But that's for another time. So I get to the Wang Center, unannounced. I don't have a ticket. I don't even know where I'm going to stay. I fly out to Boston from Chicago, and I have the cabbie take me to this nameless little place on the ocean, and it's a nice little motel, and I have a nice dinner, a crab, and I open the phone book, and I'm trying to find Chris O'Connor, who was Chris's road manager. And I'm trying to find Chris O'Connor, who was John's road manager at the time. And I find Chris at the second or third place I call in the phone book. And we talk, and he's like, what are you doing here? I'm like, well, not really sure. He goes, well, look, he'll have 15 minutes before the show, and I'm sure he'd be glad to see you. And no problem. Do you have a ticket to the show? I said, no. He goes, I'll get you a ticket. Just go to security before the show. A good half hour. I said, great. And which means an hour and a half, because I got to do warm up and all that kind of stuff. So I go walk the Boston Commons, and I got to tell you, it was a scene out of Courier and Ives. You know, the Boston Commons is an incredible thing, and snowing, real big snowflakes down and like that. And I go to the security office ahead of time, and my name's there, and I'm sitting there waiting, waiting, and waiting, and waiting, and finally, after a very long time, Chris and John and James Burton and Jim Horn and a bunch of these guys all come walking in, and John looks at me and he's like puzzled, like, what are you doing here? I just kind of looked at him. So Chris comes over and says, listen, we had a, you know, weather delay. We don't have time. He goes, but you can go to the concert, you know, and I really apologize. I said, sure, fine, whatever. Cause I didn't even know what the hell I was doing there. So how could I argue with the guy? So he takes me to this room underneath the theater stage, the Wang Center stage, and all of John's guitars are getting tuned up in there. He's here, just, you know, hang out here. The guy will come and get you. You go sit. Okay, fine. As I'm sitting there, all of a sudden I have this urge. I'm thinking, I got to talk to this guy, and I don't know why. So being the guy that I was, I don't know that I'd still do all the stuff I've done years ago today, but I decided to get up. I didn't fly here for no reason. I get up and I walk up on the stage, on the far side of the stage, and they all stop and look at me. And Chris comes over. He's like, man, you can't be on the stage, dude. And I'm like, listen, where are you going to be tomorrow night? Because I'll meet you there. He says, well, be in Pittsburgh. I said, I'll see you there. Thanks for the ticket. He goes, all right, hold on. He's got maybe 5 minutes after the show, but he's got this big press thing and blah, blah, blah. But if you can just go back to the same room, the security guy will bring it back. Maybe you get 5 minutes. Okay, fine. Great concert. John's knocking it out of the park. Beautiful songs, and he's in great voice, and they raise a shitload of money for Catholic Charities in Boston. And I go downstairs afterwards, and I'm waiting and waiting and waiting. He finally comes out, gives me a hug. He says, what are you doing here? And I come up with the best statement ever. I said, I thought you'd know. And he did not know. But what he said was, did you bring me something? And all of a sudden I had this little mini epiphany, because I had been speaking at schools for just a little while back then about different environmental things. I was working my degree, which was environmental interpretation and communication. And so part of that was me talking at schools and trying to get information out to young people that I thought was important that they may not get in science class. So anyway, I had letters that some of these kids had written to me. And I had them in the pocket of that jacket. I still have the jacket. And I had and I take these out and I give them these letters. For, you know, again, totally unrehearsed. I just, here you go. Maybe this is it. And he's starting to read these letters. And he gets this big smile on his face. And when John smiled, it was like he got out of school early. You know, like you got an extra $50 in your paycheck. This big, broad grin. And he looks at me and he says, do you have any idea what you're doing here, pal? But not really. I flew here on a whim. I don't, you know, and I get that. But no, do you understand what you're doing? No. He puts his right hand on my shoulder. He looks me dead bolt in the eyes and he says, your voice matters. Do you know your voice matters? And I did not. I had no concept of that, no clue, no idea, no reason, no reality of that. And he just stood there with his hand on my shoulder. It was like a moment frozen in time. I'm closing my eyes as I do this podcast thinking about that. And he said, the coming years will prove me correct. They'll prove me right that you have something big to do. And your voice matters, John. No big bells and whistles, really. Just this kind of warm feeling like, never thought of that. So he says, hey, put these letters back in the bag, my bag, which is his. And, you know, I appreciate that. I'll take them. I got to go to this press thing. It's great to see you. I give him a hug. We promise to stay in touch. I put the letters in the bag. Off he goes. Off I go. And I feel, wow, you know, this was what the trip was all about. It was worth it to do this. And I fly back to Chicago and everybody's like, what happened? I go, well, I can't really tell you. It's kind of this and this, and these letters. Okay, fine. Maybe 4 months later, maybe 3 months later, I don't know. It was like the first of the year in 1992 it would have been then. I get a call from John's office at the Windstar Foundation in Snowmass, Colorado at the time. And it's somebody, I couldn't tell you who it was, but some of their executive director or whatever, saying, you know, Mr. Denver brought those letters to our meeting. And he said that, you know, if this guy's doing this in Chicago, we should be doing things for education. So they were going to start doing like a Windstar elementary education type structure somehow. So thank you so much. And it was like the spark that did, oh, great. So then I could at least say, hey, this was all worth it. You know, I bought the airline ticket. This worked out. The ripple effect was taking place. Things are going. And I thought that was the end of it. That was not the end of it. That was the beginning of it. I was teaching high school at the time at my alma mater. I mentioned Schurz High School a little bit earlier. I was teaching there in the early 90s. And one day in my inbox, I got this flyer from Windstar announcing that in 1994, so this would have been going into, I always get these dates wrong. I have to go back and look, but it's a long time ago. Anyway, I get this thing in the mail saying that the next year's symposium is Choices for the Future of the Human Family. And something else clicked in my head. I couldn't get those words out. The human family, the human family. So when I remember covering a German class, feebly, no doubt, because I'm German and I can speak it, but not I'm not a teacher of it. But I remember covering the class and I kept looking at this thing and it would not let my attention wander. The human family. It was a very strange day at school. Chopped my way through the classes. All the way home, these words were going through my head. I got home. I was living on the northwest side in a big townhouse. I went out to the yard. So this would have been September, October of God, it's got to be 90, got to be 93. Nope, 92. It would have been that fall of 92. And I wrote these words out to this human family thing. It was like a poem or a song or a lyric, whatever. That I'd never done anything like that. It's long before I wrote books. And I wrote this thing out. And when I finished writing it, I had this overwhelming feeling I was going to speak this next year in Aspen. I hadn't done anything except talk about a few schools. And here I had written this lyric and just, you're supposed to do this next year in Aspen. Oh, okay, right. I mean, this is a place where they have like Jacques Cousteau show up, right? And heavyweights from the world, David Brower from all these people, that, you know, United Nations and stuff. And what am I going to do there? I was literally teaching, I was a substitute teacher at my high school. Every day I was there, but I was a substitute teacher. And I did some sports marketing on the side. What the hell was I going to talk about? So skipping a whole lot, just to keep this thing as short as possible, that whole next year that was a roller coaster ride up and down, I felt I was going to be there, didn't think I was going to be there. Felt I was going to be there, didn't think I'd be there. My friend Ginny Weissman, who I've known for 30 years now, was witness to all this. It's like one day I'm like, I think it's going to happen. Next day I'm like, what the hell's going on here? It would not leave me alone. 2 weeks before the planned symposium that year in 1993, I get a phone call. And I'm downstairs cleaning the cat box when the phone rings upstairs. And we didn't even have, like, we may have inline voicemail, but it's like, I think I need to go answer that. So I'm cleaning shit out of the cat box, a very zen-like thing to do. And the phone rings. Any reason to get out of doing that, I'll take it. So I run upstairs. It's John's office. Hold on, please. And JD gets on the phone. And he says, so what are you doing in 2 weeks? I said, well, we're coming out to the you know, symposium. I'm really looking forward to it. He said, well, Dr. Mae Jemison, who was the first female black astronaut in American history, was slated to speak, and she canceled. And I'd like you to talk. Wait, what? He said, are you busy? I'm like, well, no, I think I can pull this off. And I went from a guy who was cleaning the cat box and didn't really understand that his voice mattered, that I had anything to add to the dialogue and conversation of the world, to standing on stage just a few weeks later in Aspen, Colorado. And Rollin Smith, who is the MC, this incredible guy who's got this great, booming, wonderful voice, who's in the news for years, you know, he's introducing everybody. And I can remember standing backstage, and the woman in front of me, who had spoke first, Dr. Theo Coburn, the late Dr. Theo Coburn, had like these reams of paper, you know, with all this facts and figures. She was from the World Wildlife Federation, and she had assistants. And I remember having the matches from the hotel, and I wrote some words on the back, like reminders. Never used a script in my life. They give me the words, I use them the best I can. And she just had spent, you know, 48 minutes talking about the whole, how the world's falling apart, and I'm supposed to follow this and make people feel better. So anyway, I got up, and Roland did the introduction, and it was the first time that I realized that something else was going on besides what I thought was going on for my life. And ever since that day that those dominoes flicked in Aspen, I realized they are connected to the dominoes that got flicked 2 years earlier in the Wang Center at Boston. And so John not only saw something in me I couldn't see in myself, he also supported it and put it into action. And for that, I'm forever grateful. I don't always understand it, but I'm grateful for it. And I've spent all these years since doing whatever I can to remind people that their voice matters too. And I think that those type of things matter greatly. So what I want to leave you with is these lyrics, this poem that I wrote all those years ago that I think encapsulates a lot of what I'm going to be talking about later this morning and everything I've mentioned in this podcast as well. I actually gave these lyrics to John later, and he put it in his back pocket. I thought, you could sell about 7 million, you know, copies of that. We could all retire. He could retire many times over, but that never happened. But later, years later, a guy named Frank Delamar actually put music to these words, and I'm a credited songwriter somewhere, so it's kind of cool. But this is how it sounded back in 1993 when I spoke at the Windstar Choices for the Future Symposium, The Human Family. And this is what I will end with today, later this morning, at the Abbey in Lake Geneva. Have you ever sat and wonder at the setting of the sun, or how a flower blossoms and that summer always comes? Have you ever held a snowflake or dried a small child's tear? Have you ever dreamed of peace and love throughout your living years? You're the heart of the human family, the promise of life to come, the pulse of the living world, and you're the only one. Have you ever walked in the rain and smelled the sweetness of drops in the wind, or ever knelt in humble prayer in forgiveness of imagined sin? Have you ever hurt so bad that you swear you'd really rather die? And then you woke the next morning to see rainbows in the sky. You're the eyes of the human family, the promise of life to come, a prophet of faith and giver of dreams, and you are the only one. Have you ever seen the hunger in the children of the land and watched as we consume ourselves, destroying what we don't understand? Have you ever stood in silence as the leaders slowly take their fall and prayed for their legacies and all those names on cold stone walls? You're the voice of the human family, the promise of life to come, a singer of songs for all the world, and your greatest has just begun. And on this day, today, this precious day, sit and wonder at the miracle that you truly are, and know that your light shines from the heavens within, and it's as bright as the midnight star. And dream your dreams of a world without hunger, where the children never shed cruel tears, and know that you can make that happen by living through untrue fears. We are the human family with footsteps in the sand, and we are the human family walking hand in hand. We are the human family. We're responsible for all we see. We are the human family, and the truth will set you free. Thanks for listening. Thanks to the subscribers of the Life 2.0 podcast. Until next time, safe travels. Adios.